Hi there! Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 252, and I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me are my very good friends, James Jones.
Welcome to my Australian farm.
And Greg Leahy.
Oh, hey, hey, everyone.
These guys are super, super, super happy tonight because the lockout is over.
It is.
And possibly for other reasons as well, as we'll get into. And, yeah, of course, John is not here this week. He's actually super busy with work. So we're hoping he'll be back next week. It's kind of up in the air right now. If he's not back next week,
we'll kill him.
We'll try to get on a special guest to fill in. But it is a three-man show this week. But we're just happy to be back at all. You know, we took last week off, and a lot has happened since then. We've played a lot of games, and the world is kind of a different place. Especially for a certain handheld system. So, the first email this week is from Jet Pilot, who writes, "The 3DS isn't selling as well as Nintendo predicted. Games are being delayed and possibly canceled because of the less-than-stellar 3DS hardware sales. Nintendo has said that they are aware of the marketing challenges presented by the 3DS and that consumers need to experience the 3D effect in person, as it is not something that can be displayed via traditional methods. Coupled with the fact that to the casual observer, the 3DS looks very similar to the DS, it is clear that Nintendo has some unique challenges to overcome. With this in mind, how does Nintendo expect to sell the 3DS by using the following marketing materials?" And Jet Pilot attached an image of a store display that he found, I think in a Best Buy or a GameStop. And it was, he said that he'd seen them in a lot of different stores. And it's basically Nintendo's current standard marketing kiosk for their DS family of systems. And it's just, it's a DS Lite, it's a DSi, it's a DSi XL.
TM, by the way.
And it's a 3DS, all next to, it's just pictures of them, all lined up next to each other. And the 3DS really is not made bigger than the others. It's not made more special looking than the others. It's really, it's not really a 3DS marketing thing so much as it is an all DS marketing thing.
Right.
And I think one of the big problems with that display is that it's not really clear from looking at it how these are all different from each other. Certainly, especially the 3DS, which is the new expensive one. So Jet Pilot sent this in last week, and of course he, at the time, he could not have known the megaton that would drop this morning, the day that we record this. So you guys want to address what happened today?
And it's huge. I mean, let's talk about it first of all. We're talking about a price cut of a third globally.
Yes,
a third of the price,
more or less in every territory. The numbers are slightly, in America it's slightly less than a third because it's going from 250 to 170.
Yep.
In Japan it's slightly more than a third because they're taking a whole 10,000 yen off the 25,000 price. Then with Europe, you know, it's a question of the trade price being cut, and then the retailers will decide.
Exactly. Name your own price.
Where they're going to pitch it. But, I mean, for a start, that fact in Japan is very interesting. Because, obviously, if we've seen the NPDs over the past few months while the 3DS has been on the market in America, and it's been handily outsold by the DS. Obviously, in fact, the DS is still selling pretty much about as well as any platform in America. It's been, you know, consistently doing quite well, about 300,000 or so in the last month or whatever it was. Meanwhile, the 3DS has been sort of ticking along much lower. If you contrast that with Japan, I'm sure Nintendo hasn't been happy with it, clearly. But at the same time, it's been selling, you know, close to pretty much as well as any system is selling in Japan.
Right.
And now you're cutting the price by more than a third there. That is astonishing to me that they are being so aggressive there in their own market, where it seems like it was doing quite a lot better than it is in America.
Certainly it could have done better, but it also could have done much worse.
It seems to be ticking along a lot more healthily there. I mean, globally, if you remember, their original target for the end of the fiscal year, which of course was the whole reason why they launched it when they did, they wanted to get it into the end of the last fiscal year and give their figures a bump for that period. They wanted to get 4 million sold around the world in that time. And they came a little short, relatively, you know, a few hundred thousand short of a 4 million figure. But since that time, they've only sold about what's, I think the figures are like 700,000 more In the 3 months from the end of that quarter to the end of the second, they've only sold a few hundred thousand more, which means even now they're only a little ahead of the target they had for it to sell in its first like 5 weeks. So clearly that is why they've reacted the way they have, even though maybe the problems are somewhat more acute in North America and Europe. They have decided to act across the board with what is, I mean, this is unprecedented. A cut of this scale.
It's nuclear.
A cut of this scale, not even 6 months after it comes out in America and Europe. And also the fact that apparently, according to a report in Bloomberg, the system will now be sold at some sort of a loss.
Yes.
Accounting for all the different kinds of costs that are involved. We think that the components add up to somewhere north of $100, but then you've got the distribution, the assembly.
Marketing
as well. Yeah. However poorly Jet Pilot might think it's doing.
Exactly.
It still costs money. So we always say, Nintendo, they don't sell stuff at a loss. All this kind of, they've been price cuts before, like especially I think to sort of like N64 in Europe. I think that got cut pretty quickly because it really did not fare well from the beginning, but a global cut of this scale, this quickly for a Nintendo platform is really quite unprecedented.
Right. And we, now, I don't know. I mean, maybe we do know, but I don't think we have a concept of what the scale of loss we're discussing is.
No. I mean, they might be just edging. It might be virtually break even. We don't know.
Right. I doubt they would go so far as to really hurt themselves.
What we do know, though, is worth mentioning that Nintendo sort of announced this alongside their revised earnings forecasts for their investors. And so what they have done now, obviously they expect to sell more 3DSs, but now they're going to be selling them at something of a loss,
yes,
as opposed to a healthy margin that they had before. They have cut that earnings forecast by more than 80%.
Ooh.
So, hey, investors, all that money we said we were going to make for you, actually, we're going to make about under a quarter of that. It's really a drastic cut, but clearly they think it has to be done for the long-term health of the platform.
Right.
And they're correct. But, that I would say that revised earnings forecast could also, I'm sure it is also taking into account that they're not selling nearly as much software as they expected to be at this point. Because they expect to sell more hardware, but along with that is, 2 to 3 games per system. And even those of us who did buy a system haven't bought 2 to 3 games for it. Certainly not at full price.
Yeah, I think the attach rate is about 3 if you look at global.
It's about 1 for me, but I'll come to that later.
So that's where they are currently. But you're right, that's some of it. They expect to sell more software now because they expect to sell more hardware with it. But apparently of the 80 so odd percent of the cut in revenue that they're expected to generate now, they are saying that about 40% of that will be accounted for by the fact that they're making this huge drop in margin on the 3DS itself. So it's still a big chunk of it, as well as, it seems like the Wii and the DS are still falling a little short of where they had those selling as well.
And Wii software is...
And the software there as well. So it is an across-the-board thing that's contributing to such a massive drop in the earnings forecast. But if there's one single major thing in it, it is this move that they're making to discount the system. So it tells you something about the severity of the situation as they perceive it, that it's worthwhile to take that kind of hit in the short term.
So in the other end of it, though, to sort of deal with the software issue, they went ahead and announced a little bit more details on their Mario games for the year, both the Mario Kart and the Mario 3D game, and gave them terrible names, which is fantastic.
Well, I think the Mario Kart name is kind of cool.
No, it's not.
I don't know. There's something kind of clean about it.
You can't just start numbering games at 7.
Mario Kart 7. It's interesting.
You can't do that.
It just sounds nice to me. I don't know.
You have to start sooner than that. You can't just be like, you can't pull a Windows.
But I do like that they're getting away from calling everything blank 3D.
Well, no, now they're calling it blank 3D blank.
So Super Mario, as it was before, is now Super Mario 3D Land. Not Super Mario Land 3D, Super Mario 3D.
But there's already been a Super Mario Land 3, so they couldn't use that pun. So I'm sure their creative team had to scratch their heads for a couple hours to figure out how to deal with this.
Super Mario 3D Land. What? What?
Well, it's weird. It's kind of invoking Super Mario Land, which has been a brand that's been sort of dormant since the 90s.
But this game has jack shit to do with Super Mario Land.
Yeah, it does. It's funny. One of the things that I did with my week off, I got to play some of the E3 demos. I had them in London. We'll talk about this later in more detail. But one of the things I took from it was, how are they going to market this Mario game? And of course, a big part of how they're going to market it is, what the hell are they going to call it? Because all they've got so far is Super Mario. That's the most non-committal placeholder title one could possibly have for a Mario game. So, you know, I wondered what they were going to do with it. And yeah, apparently it's this. It's a pretty strange choice in my view, but I suppose, you know, it does have to sort of emphasize the 3D to some extent.
Well, so I guess the reasoning they went with Land instead of World is because it's a handheld game.
But, yeah, but it's just because it's been so long.
I know.
I mean, obviously, the eShop has brought Super Mario Land back.
So was New Super Mario Brothers. That was a handheld game.
Well, yeah, I know, but their press release sort of discusses its handheldian nature, so I presume that's... The problem is there's already a Super Mario Land 3.
Yeah.
And they couldn't call it Super Mario Land 4D because that would be confusing as hell.
So, by the way, as Greg alluded to, we are going to do new business later in the show. I just thought it would be fun to change things up, like the Bombcast, and lead off with the biggest story of the week, of the month or the year, possibly.
So, Mario 3D, November. Mario Kart
7.
December.
Mario Kart 7. Just say it, James. You can say it.
It needs a new name.
Mario Kart 7. I think that is... I can't explain it, but I think that's kind of badass. I don't know why.
Because it's terrible. It's like watching a bad movie.
It's a hell of a lot better than Mario Kart Wii and Mario Kart DS, which were both horrible names.
Well, I mean, if we look at it, the fact is that Mario Kart DS and Wii, whether you find them to be pleasant names or not, absolutely massive sellers.
Right.
Just humongous. So you'd think they'd be pretty eager to stick with that naming convention because, you know, it certainly, if it hasn't helped, it hasn't done anything wrong either, you know.
Well, I don't think they're exactly throwing people off the Mario Kart scent by calling it Mario Kart 7.
But I think it's also the reason why they haven't just gone to 3DS is probably because they fear that maybe people, again, speaking a bit to sort of Jet Pilot's point, is that if you just call it Mario Kart 3DS, do people think it's just like some sort of 3D-ized version of the game that already exists?
So that's the Nintendogs plus Cats corollary, where in Japan they changed the box art of Nintendogs plus Cats because people couldn't tell the difference between it and Nintendogs.
So one thing we haven't mentioned at all yet is the Nintendo 3DS Ambassador Program.
It's like being invited to an elite club that requires an $80 membership fee.
Yeah, also known as the Nintendo 3DS Suckers Club. And I also joke that maybe alongside this, they should launch the Nintendo Wii Survivors Program for those of us who still play our Wiis and still want to buy games for it.
Well, I want to buy games for it, but I don't play it. Does that count? Am I a member?
Let me weave a tale for you that happened just about 12 hours ago today. I woke up this morning and I turn on my Wii because, number one, I want to weigh in on Wii Fit channel, which I do often. And number two, I wanted to check the Nintendo download press release, mainly for 3DS stuff. Not that I really ever expect anything good on Virtual Console or WiiWare these days.
Shut your mouth.
That's part of my Thursday morning ritual. If I have time, I like to check the press release and see what's coming out today, even though I won't have time to download or play it until I get off work.
Well, that's okay. The press release comes out 4 hours before the game's due anyway, so you're fine.
Yeah, yeah. So I turn it on. I figure, well, you know, I've already got the Wii on to weigh in, so I'm going to hop over to the internet channel and check it. And what I find instead is this thing about 3DS price. I'm like, what? This is kind of out of the blue. So I click on it, and you know, I'm still kind of sleepy, and I'm rolling through this press release, and I see new price $169.99.
Did you have a lucid dream?
I thought I was having a lucid dream, and I kind of reached up and like rubbed my eyes because I don't even know if I have my contacts in or anything. I thought maybe it says $199, and I'm just not, maybe my vision's too blurry this morning. And I like stepped up closer. I was like, that actually says $169.99. And I'm not kidding. Literally, my first thought was somebody hacked Nintendo's press site.
It's been going on a lot.
Like, are you fucking kidding me? $169.99? That cannot be right. My eyes are wide at this point. I'm like, what am I dreaming? What is going on here? And then I scroll down And before I get to the end of the press release, I'm thinking, this is a massive, massive salvo against the competition and against the market lethargy. But also, doesn't this suck for everybody who just bought a 3DS? I mean, I bought mine more than a month ago, you know, about 6 weeks ago before E3. My friend Kevin just bought one like 2 weeks ago.
Well, now he's an ambassador.
I'm thinking he's really going to be kind of pissed because he paid $80 too much for this thing. And then I kept scrolling and then I saw the ambassador program and it said, they'll be able to download 20 free games. And again, I kind of rubbed my eyes. I'm like, does that say 20? 20 free games? Are you shitting me? What is going on this morning? What is this that I'm reading? 20 free games? And then I thought, well, they're all going to be stuff like Mario Land and Donkey Kong and, you know, Shantae and like all this stuff that I've already downloaded. Fuck. And then I see what it is and it's 10 NES games and 10 GBA games. So they implicitly announced that they're actually bringing GBA games to the service for the first time ever.
Yeah, that's brilliant. What's brilliant about it though? Implicitly they did. Explicitly they said they wouldn't. Because they say, well, they're exclusive to the ambassadors. We have no plans to do this in the future, honestly.
I'd say they're exclusive until about January.
I think there's a few things about this. First of all, the fact that they've admitted that NES is coming to Game Boy Virtual Console before the end of the year, basically. Mm-hmm. So that is happening, and this ambassador program has basically just tipped their hand on that probably a bit earlier than they would otherwise have revealed that. But I do think it clearly reveals that Game Boy Advance will be happening, but it may be happening a long time down the road. Because I think if you look at the lessons they've drawn from the Virtual Console experience on Wii, whether you think they're the right lessons or not, is that they did too much too soon. They did too many platforms at the same time that kind of cannibalized each other.
Who wants your Master System games?
Because, I mean, we know they've got Game Gear, they've got Turbo Express, but yeah, there's no sign of them coming yet. You know, clearly they're taking the long view and say we're going to space these out over a long period of time. And so the Game Boy Advance games might be coming 18 months from now. And then once they start, goodness knows how long it will actually take for a real catalogue of them to build up. So what we're getting is probably a very advanced preview with those GBA games.
So buried in their announcement was the fact that these aren't the, quote, final versions of these releases, and their words, not ours, implicitly stating there will be a final version of these releases.
Well, I mean, certainly for the NES games, they're very clear about that. What that means is, as we've had Matt Walker's translated some of this stuff for us, like, you know, specific points like, you know, the menu functionality is not going to be as full.
Hmm,
and, you know, if you're playing a GBA game, I think it'll almost be like you're playing a GBA game on your DS, you know, like the 3DS will think it's a DS playing a GBA game. That's kind of what it sounds like in terms of how much the menu functionality and like the, you know, Street Pass and all that is tapered down in that scenario. So you're going to be playing these versions of the games that don't have the full shell on them, like save states are not going to be as comprehensive. And in that sense, it's kind of be weird, like almost playing like prototype versions
right.
of them.
Now, I do believe you're going to be able to get those if you get the Ambassador Editions where you can parallel park in Fire Zones for free. I think in when they finally release these, you do get to download the...
Yeah, you get to upgrade for free.
So you'll get to have all your copies of Metroid Fusion. All of them. Your busted-ass version that you get with the Ambassador program and then the final version.
No, that only applies to the NES games, the part about them being sort of...
Yeah, well, because they're not admitting that they are going to release the GBA games.
Yeah.
We know that what they've said explicitly what they're doing for NES, so we could put that in the bank. But with the GBA games, I think it is still possible that you may be able to upgrade those as well eventually. But they're not admitting it yet.
The reason it seems pretty clear that they do have an upgrade in mind for these GBA games is that when they structured the discussion of the NES version upgrades, they basically took the first paragraph of that and wrote it for the GBA version, then left out the second paragraph part. The structure indicates to me that they probably have a similar tactic in place for the GBA, but maybe not as soon.
No, it's going to be further down the line because that is their plan. They believe if you put GBA games up against you know, GBC games, original Game Boy games, or whatever, that, that it's just going to ultimately cost them sales.
Right.
If they leave it so that, you know, if the Game Boy games could dominate it for a while, then the NES games could dominate a while, and so on, until, you know, maybe 2013 they put the GBA games on there, and then they could dominate it. But if you're an ambassador, you can have 10 games, you know, early, even if they're a bit diminished in terms of their feature set. But they also showed 5 titles that would be included in both these ranges. Mm-hmm. So we know half of what the games are going to be,
right,
but not the other half. But it indicates the sort of things we're getting. And for GBA, you know, it's real top-line first-party kind of stuff. So you've got the original WarioWare, Yoshi's Island, Metroid Fusion, as James mentioned already. You know, that's the sort of thing you're getting there. And then on the NES side, you've got Super Mario Brothers, Legend of Zelda, DK Jr., the Ice Climbers.
Those are all early NES games too.
Yeah, those are the early NES games. I mean, some people have thought that, is it a case that they're actually kind of like the GBA versions as well? Because of course you had the NES classics on GBA, but the fact that there are these differences between how they're being emulated suggests not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this morning, when to kind of go against Johnny's story, when I check my email when I get to work first thing, and I saw 3 Nintendo press releases from the very, so all the Nintendo press releases from each division have like a structure to their headline, the subject line, so I can tell what region a press release came from. I basically had all 3 regions stacked on top of each other and went, oh shit, what happened? Like I didn't even read them. I just clicked the first one and said price drop, what the next, what the f-? And I got to America and I saw the number. I was like, what the hell? And then I jumped out and saw that our news team had been absolutely bang up last night and did a great job getting this moving. So good job for them.
It was shocking for me when I saw it, because we talked about it just on 250. You know, the people say, oh, you know, when's the price cut going to come? And my firm belief was that they would see it through to the holiday, see what kind of bump they were going to get. And then if it wasn't enough, if it wasn't the sort of bump they should be getting at a holiday, you know, Nintendo is a company leveraged on the holidays like virtually no other. I mean,
right,
they get these humongous spikes at that time of year. It really does, you know, see them through for the rest, especially in America. So I thought, you know, they would kind of stay the course until then and then maybe adjust after that. And you know, the obvious point would be, as Johnny kind of implied, to $199, to just get under that psychological barrier of 200
right,
bucks, and maybe, you know, see, try that. But you know, to go,
they went straight up like salvos
to go
on
so much further. So basically now, I mean, this is the interesting part, going back to Jet Pilot sort of take on how they're presented as different sort of systems, the 3DS and the other DSs, is that it's now in the ballpark with the DSi, DSi XL.
They're going to have to drop the price on those other ones again, because now they're too close to the 3DS.
But the thing is, they've said that they have no plans to do that. And, you know, the thing is that they are selling well in America again. And the thing is, their margins on that are healthy. So
right,
I don't know that you want to cut that, because haven't their earnings fell enough?
Yeah.
True. But what it does, though, is that sort of, you know, we expect this huge price drop to, you know, definitely elicit a boost in sales. But it does also only emphasize the problem that Jetpilot's talking here, in that they need more nuanced and more clever marketing to actually say, this is a different system, this is a generational leap, and it has stereoscopic 3D without glasses.
But you realize what they're buying now. They're buying word of mouth. Because
right,
with less than 1 million units sold in 3-4 months in America, they don't have that much word of mouth. It's something that you need to see in person and that you need to convey directly to other people how cool it is, and you can't do that if nobody's buying the system. So
yeah,
this is almost like in itself a new way to market the 3DS, rather than try to do some kind of gimmicky, you know.
I mean, that's what really drove the Wii, honestly, was you showed people the Wii and they're like, oh wow, this is really cool.
But there is still, you know, there is still the issue now, in terms of, you could argue it's harder than ever for them, you know, to appeal to, you know, say for instance the head of a household who is going to be making a purchase decision about a present for Christmas,
right,
who is not going to be going off that kind of word of mouth as to why is this better. You know, I mean, before, the price was a barrier, but it also inferred that it was better.
Right.
Well, they've got some time before then to actually improve their literal marketing efforts.
They do, but what I'm saying is that this has to be part of the plan as well to make it work. It's that, you know, almost like a relaunch to say, right, you know, we need to rethink about how exactly we're going to appeal, because the danger of it seeming like it's just a DSi with stereoscopic 3D that somehow like magically makes your old games 3D is greater than ever now.
Well, yeah, and I think the other thing they need to worry about is they need to make it clear that we've dropped the price. Because if people have just come to the decision that that 3DS is expensive, they might find that suddenly the price drop doesn't necessarily get their attention if they didn't, you know, they don't buy
their
3DS news.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure retailers are going to be a big part in that, and I'm sure retailers have been a big part in this generally.
But I mean, I think they almost need to emphasize in advertising how much of a price drop it is.
Right, but as I said, I think the retailers will do that for them in many ways. I mean, you know, because I imagine the retailers are some of the people who've been saying to Nintendo, you know, things aren't going well, you got to give us a reason to keep pushing this. And it's a lot easier for them to push it now. They could say, this is an incredible bargain. It just came down by a third.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, as the all three of us already own the system, so we're going to be the ambassadors. We're going to get a bunch of free download games. And it's a strange apology sort of placating move on Nintendo's part just because of the sheer bulk of what they're doing. I mean, when am I going to have time to play 20 download games on my 3DS? You know, like, it's just overwhelming. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, on one hand, you can say, well, it doesn't really cost Nintendo $80 to feed out these games to people. And that's true. But the opportunity cost could actually be more than $80, because I'm sure the, you know, when they eventually price all these games out for everyone else, if you add up all those prices, it's going to be more than $80. And the thing is that the early adopters who they're giving these games away to are the type of people who probably would have bought a large percentage of these anyway when they eventually came out, and now they're not going to because they're getting them for free.
Even if they've owned them before on another system,
right.
You know, they got those GBA codes. There are GBA games that I like enough that I would like to have them, you know, more instantly available on because I don't have to switch out cartridges or get a different DS or anything. I mean, they have lost sales in that sense. But there is another side to this coin that I think Nintendo may have been inspired by somewhat. Now, Mike Sklens on our site had the blog up today recalling the similarity to the iPhone situation, where that started at $600, you know, which was very high, seemed very high. It came down quite soon after to $400, you know, that was a third of the price knocked off. And their sort of apology came a bit later when they kind of realized just how sort of negative the backlash was on the part of some of the early adopters. And they had like a $100 gift voucher or something. So there's definite similarities there, but I think Nintendo have been inspired by the Welcome Back program with the PSN, because there is data apparently to suggest that the PSN Welcome Back program has actually expanded awareness of the downloadable games that are available on PS3 and have started to increase sales of new games. So people who have got games for free, maybe they just never really got into the whole buying games off PSN thing, but they were motivated to go and download them for free. And since then, they've started to show more interest in buying further ones. And so it's actually expanded that part of the market for Sony. So what Nintendo have done is, first of all, they haven't waited like Apple did for everyone to get annoyed about it. They've actually been sort of proactive in that sense. So they're obviously reacting to the bad sales, but they're getting out in front of any negative reaction from the fans. But then also they may think, well, obviously a lot of the early adopters are Nintendo fans that, you know, were eager to buy old games digitally. Sure, but there's some people who bought it early that are not into that. But if we give them this endowment of 20 free games, maybe we can get them into it. Well, that's what it is.
Are we going to live off the interest?
So, you know, that could be a way of actually expanding the part of the Nintendo market that's interested in their digital offerings, which, as we've said many times, has been a problem on their previous platforms, that there is, you know, whatever is right or wrong with the digital services on Nintendo platforms, there's just so many people who own it that they're kind of just oblivious to it one way or the other. And this might actually help alleviate that problem to the probably the relatively small amount of people, admittedly, within the early adopter crowd that would fall into that category. But I think it would be some people. So it has some upside in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that for the case of the PSN, Sony does an even worse job publicizing their download stuff than Nintendo does.
That's bold words, especially coming from you, with what you've said about the way they publicize.
Well, Nintendo tries. They're just really bad at it. But Microsoft obviously is the king of that territory. I mean, they devote huge amounts of resources to it. And I can certainly see the other two players recognizing that this is now much more important going forward than it was even a couple years ago. That with the expansion of application marketplaces on handheld devices, people have become much more comfortable buying their software online in these sort of small transactions. And I would think that maybe this will provide some opportunity to get people to get accustomed to using these.
I just think you're overblowing the potential for this thing to open people's eyes to the fact that you can download games on this thing. They've already done that with the Pokedex 3D and with Excitebike 3D. And
well, yeah, it's an extension of that sort of.
It is.
It's a much more dramatic.
For the people who already own the 3DS and are going to qualify for this program, they've probably already downloaded their free games from the eShop. So I just don't know what the potential is to get the last five people who didn't know you could do that.
Well, I think they issued plenty of caveats on the scale of it.
Yeah. But it's just, that's not, they're doing it, this is an apology.
What I'm saying is there is a something of an offset. You know, the point is like, I don't think Sony are particularly happy about what happened to the PSN. But
God, that hacking was great. Sure. I'm glad we had to rebuild it for 2 months.
There's something of a silver lining there that they can take from it. And maybe they can build in the future, on some of these initiatives where they raise awareness, because once they actually do have the price cut, if they do get the kind of sales surge that they're looking for, you're going to have a lot more people who may be a lot less attuned to what's going on in the digital space, that you've also got to get them aware and them in the habit of, I mean, there's awareness and then there's the habit of actually going to the store and downloading things, which I think is kind of where the PSN thing kind of came in. So it's something they're going to have to consider for the, I think more, even more importantly, for the next generation of 3DS owners.
So, you know, I think the price cut is really good for people who don't already have a 3DS, because that's a pretty good value. I mean, this system does a lot of things. It doesn't have many games yet, true, which is a big problem. I mean, nothing about today's announcement changes the fact that I'm probably not going to own a second 3DS game card until October.
I wonder if the returns from the launch of Zelda are a factor in this, because it's been about, what, a month now?
Mm-hmm.
So they can pretty much gauge its long-term effect on 3DS sales. And if I recall, it did have a bump, but maybe it wasn't.
It definitely had a bump. And, you know, the game itself showed up in the MPDs, the other 3DS games have not gone nearly that high.
Right.
You know, so it made an impression. But if they were counting on that to deliver a very big bump,
they were crazy, because that game's 13 years old.
That was probably wishful thinking, but they may have waited until they could be absolutely sure.
Right. I was wondering, because the timing here seems a bit arbitrary.
Well,
right?
I mean, I think there's a few things with the timing. I mean, first of all, they may wish to get the price cut a little out of the way to kind of get some sales momentum brewing before the holiday season as well, just so, as Johnny said, yeah, some of that word of mouth gets going, you know, and the platform has a better perception surrounding it before we go into the holiday. If you wait too long, it's a bit too late in the day to just expect it to do all the work. So it is kind of weird that we're having this big price cut, and yet it's going to be another month before you can really think of anything vaguely notable on 3DS with Star Fox. And even then, that's another old game.
Yeah.
You know, so that's limited. And then you're talking about till November for Super Mario 3D Land. So the price cut is well in advance of the games to kind of go with it. But I do think it's a question of building momentum. And also maybe just to, you know, I think this story has the potential also to stain the reputation of the platform a bit, you know, that it's a lemon.
It's a bomba.
Right.
Bomba.
And so I think they also think they can kind of ride that out in the summer. And then hopefully by the time that Mario's ready to sort of prop up the platform with both of his games.
Yeah. People just say, fuck it, it's affordable and there's a good game coming out that I want, so.
Yeah, exactly. If those Mario games can deliver as well and really say, this is a reason to own it, that you haven't had before.
This isn't Star Fox port.
No, I think everyone believes that there will eventually be a lot of great games available on the system that you can only play on this system. And that's the problem right now, is that that class of game doesn't really exist.
No.
I mean, you could argue that stuff like Pilot Wings is really great, but, you know, it's not very convincing to the mass market.
I like it, but it's not, that's not what sold the system to me.
It's not a system seller. That's just the game that you happen to buy at launch.
I don't really see that it would sell that many other people on it, and clearly, you know, it hasn't. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, look, there's a couple of ways they got into this. First of all, the software planning was not in sync with the, you know, the way that they released the console. They released the console because of the fiscal year, not because of what games they had ready for it.
Right.
That disconnect is a very big part of what we're seeing here. And it's then been exacerbated by what Jet Pilot talks about, which is the fact that, you know, the third parties are wobbling and saying, you know, we're not putting our games out there to die. We'll wait until there's actually people to buy them before we release them. Because if we release them now, when there's very few owners, they may just get forgotten.
Yeah.
And then when more people do buy it, they're not gonna go back into the past and get this game that came out a few months ago. So that's only made it worse, because it's made that desert longer. You know, I said when we talked about 250, I was interested in Shinobi. That's gone back to November, I think.
Yes.
Or December, you know. So, yeah, that's a very good example of that. So the software is the first thing. And then the second thing is, of course, the initial price, that they went as high as they did. But it's worth remembering that there were analysts after last year's E3 that were predicting / advising that Nintendo could charge as much as $300.
Yes.
Especially when, of course, we saw they were charging 25,000 yen in Japan, which roughly works out to $300. Yep. You know, that was very feasible once upon a time.
It was priced as much because we said we loved it.
But of course, I think leaving out the analysts and all that, one of the things that I think Nintendo may have influenced Nintendo's thinking with the pricing, we said before, is that they felt like they left a lot of money on the table with Wii and DS by going too low initially. And so that when they became this huge craze that sold millions, people were willing to pay more. They were, you know, they were buying them on eBay or wherever for more, and that money wasn't going to Nintendo.
I mean, I know we've talked about that before, but
I think they basically thought that we'd rather go high this time.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have to cut the price later, then so be it. We'd rather get it wrong that way around this time. But now we're seeing perhaps the real downside of that, because, you know, they perhaps could have come in at 200 or 199, whatever, and been quite, you know, people would say, oh, that's thoroughly reasonable, isn't it? And maybe would have got off to a better start, whereas now you're cutting all the way down to the point where you're actually making a loss at 170. And that's kind of why pricing is, you know, more of an art than it is a science, you know, because some of these psychological market factors are very difficult to predict.
Well, just to go back to the Wii price for a sec, I think that part of the fuel for the Wii craze when it first launched, and that carried through for a couple of years really, was the fact that the system was fairly low priced. And not that it was priced lower than PS3 or 360, because I think most of the people back then who were buying a Wii would never have considered those other systems anyway. But I think it 250 was essentially a good mass market price, and I think that was almost exactly the perfect price for Wii. And if they'd gone higher than that, to say 300 or 350, then the craze wouldn't have played out in nearly the same way. Because even though, you know, you hear these stories, yeah, people were buying them for like $500 on eBay. But those people are outliers, and those people always show up for every system, no matter what it costs. There are people who bought PS3s for $1,000 on launch day. There's stupid people out there, okay? And if you paid $500 for a Wii, you're stupid, okay? But look, part of the reason that I think the Wii was so desirable is that it had this sense of attainability. Even though, yes, it was scarce, but it wasn't prohibitively expensive. It was something that anyone in America, any family in America, could probably pull together $250, and it comes with a game. So it didn't feel like you have to buy this, and you have to go buy that, and then you have to go buy that. And, you know, Nintendo hid it in the controller costs, which I don't think any other company had ever done effectively before, or quite so effectively. But it did come with the game, and it came with the game that you wanted to play in the first place. So it felt like a fairly self-contained package, and it was not crazy expensive. So, you know, I think the idea that Nintendo felt like, well, we really should have priced that a lot higher, that would have been a mistake.
It may well have been a mistake. I think these are some of the psychological trends and things that go into it that I'm talking about, you know, and also the word of mouth. You know, there's got to be a sort of critical mass of initial adopters that can then start a word of mouth fire spreading, you know, and if you come in too high, maybe that fire never gets going. And then, you know, you'd never be in a position where people are buying it for silly prices because they don't even know it exists.
Yeah, and the Wii is easier to share as an experience than the 3DS is. So word of mouth is just not going to be as effective on 3DS.
Yeah, there are elements that are intrinsic to this particular product, you know, which after all is itself $250 bucks. Mm-hmm. But that may have been something that they thought, you know, they didn't want to go too low or too aggressive. You know, they have such a dominant position in the market that they felt we can go high, and if we have to, we can cut. And now they have, you know, had to enact that sort of plan B, but I think they've had to do it in a far more dramatic way than they would have been comfortable even entertaining the idea initially.
Well, as I said before, I mean, this news is great for anybody who doesn't already have a 3DS. And wants to get one down the road, because obviously it's going to cost you a lot less money. And it's also good in the fact that this probably will boost third-party support and, you know, a lot of other aspects of the system that are good for everybody as a community, as a user base. It's good for those of us who already bought one because, you know, we all knew that the price would drop eventually and probably in less than a year. But I certainly wasn't expecting a refund when that happened. And so, you know, I didn't, whenever the price did drop, I wasn't expecting to get anything. I was just going to say, well, you know, I've had mine a lot earlier, so I've already been enjoying mine, and that's what I paid for in the difference.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you buy something like this as an early adopter, you kind of have to expect that the price could have come down.
The 20 free games is kind of, wow. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
that's,
I mean,
awesome.
With the success of, like, you know, Wii and DS, you might well have thought, well, it could be a very long time until the price comes down if the success had been replicated. But even still, I think with a portable from Nintendo, even if it's not a price change, one thing you might be looking for is the revision.
Yeah.
The DS Lite, you know, so maybe they change the price a bit and they give you something better for your money.
And, you know, I think to some extent this is a way for Nintendo to go after the people who kind of know the pattern and were, and a lot of people were vocally just saying, I'm waiting for the second version because I don't like the first version and it's too expensive. So this is a way for Nintendo to sell a 3DS version 1 to people who otherwise probably never would have bought it.
Yeah, and I think the reason why they're feeling the need to bring those sales forward is just because they cannot have a crisis of confidence in the third-party supporters. I mean, this is very akin, to my eyes, to, you know, a government intervention in the economy. I mean, this is essentially a stimulus package. They're saying we are going to take the hit on our balance sheet in the short term because we have to see the platform through these rough times, and then after that it can take care of itself. Once the third parties know it's a going concern, their games can sell on it, the software support will be there, from that point it'll be fine. But if it doesn't get to that point, if it kind of dies a death before we even get there, then we've got a real problem. So we've got to, you know, step in, do something drastic, and keep it going until that time comes. So I do think, though, that if this has the effect that they want it to have, and everything kind of picks up at Christmas, they start to build up a healthy user base, I would expect to see that revision sooner than later, because that will be their way of putting the price back up.
And possibly cutting their manufacturing costs.
Yeah, exactly. They will be able to say, this is better, it's got better battery life, whatever's better about it, you know, the form factor again, things like that.
Right.
But at the same time, they'll be able to improve their margin by upping the price a little bit because it's better and then dropping the manufacturing costs.
Temporary price drop.
That's what it is. Basically, as I said, temporary cut is a stimulus, and that one day those debts are going to have to get repaid.
Are you going to compare this to Greek austerity measures?
I don't think there's going to be any rioting in the streets.
I want to retire at 44,
look,
damn it.
Based on the new price for 3DS, even when they do, if they put out a revision next year, they can't sell it for more than $200.
No, but
they can't go back to $250. That's
no.
Not going to fly.
You're absolutely right about that. The $200 is the new. Yeah, they will not go over that.
But at $199, they could probably still make a profit. And
sure.
In a year, I guarantee you
that. Yeah, and they want to. They are already looking at getting back to that point. Believe me.
Sure, but I also don't think they're going to take the current version of the system off the shelves. I think you'll still be able to buy it at $169 or even lower by that point. Possibly.
No, but they could do what they did with the original DS, which is we're still going to sell the we're going to cut back for production reasons.
They cut back, but they kept selling the DS Fat for a good while.
It was a phased arrangement.
It became harder to find them relatively quickly.
Look, James, the writing was on the wall. If you wanted one, you had plenty of opportunity to get one. Plenty.
Yes.
Okay. I'll tell you who this news is the best for. It's the people who were about to buy a 3DS anyway. Now they know what they're getting into, so they have a choice. But here's the best part for those people. Places like Walmart, Best Buy, all the GameStop, all the big places are probably going to start doing their own early price drops on 3DS before August 12th, because they would much rather sell you one for $200 than for $170. So they're happy to do their own internal private price drop to try to get you to buy one before August 12th. So what that means is, if you can find somewhere, and I think you will be able
to. Best Buy Canada, by the way.
Yeah, Walmart Canada is going to be selling them for $200, which is about $210. And they, you might even find lower than that. And I think a lot of stores are going to be doing this because, again, they'd like to move some of this stock at the higher price while they still can. Even though it's lower than the old price, it's higher than what it's going to be. So what that means is, if you can buy a system for $200 in the next 2 weeks, that means you're still going to get in the ambassador program as long as you connect to the eShop before midnight on August 11th. What that means is you're going to be getting 20 free classic games. Well, not free, but you're going to get 20 classic games for about $30.
Yeah, if you think it's worth that's available.
That sounds like a really good deal to me. So if you were thinking about buying one anyway and you think you might be interested in all these virtual console games that they're offering, now is the time to buy. Find the best deal that you can. You'll pay more than $170, but you're going to get a hell of a bundle of stuff with it. And you're still going to pay a lot less than we did.
Yeah, pretty much a sort of cake and eat it situation.
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome for those people. But even if you bought one last week, I don't think you can feel that burned about it, because I think the sheer size of this freebie that Nintendo's giving out to people who are early adopters.
Yeah, I would still feel a little miffed. I have noticed that Nintendo has been doing these press releases for price drops in advance recently.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the third or fourth one we've gotten in the last couple of years.
It's interesting. I think Matt Walker kind of highlighted this for us, in the internal emails, the difference between the way it was presented in the American press release and then both the Japanese and European ones, which apparently the European one is an almost direct translation of the Japanese one, which really reinforces all our sort of ideas about how Nintendo of Europe is run. But in the Japan/European case, very contrite. Like, we know you don't expect this from us. We know you're probably feeling ripped off. We're sorry. Here's our apology. Whereas the American one is like, isn't this fucking awesome?
Yeah.
very different way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. So I think we're going to wrap up this little discussion. Why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll do some new business. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a veritable slew of hands-on impressions. So first, Aaron has his hands-on impressions of Star Fox 64 3D in English this time. And next we have Danny going hands-on with Pokemon Le Tap.
Which is not in English, I guess.
It's something for iPhone in Japan. I would advise reading that just to discern whatever the hell it is. And next we have TYP's hands-on impressions of Family Fishing, which is Yuji Naka's next Wii game, after giving us such things as Let's Tap and Ivy the Kiwi.
Ivy the Kiwi?
This is a trend.
Yeah, so XSEED is bringing that to North America. We got to play it before E3, but now we can talk about it because they announced it.
Now it can be told.
It's GBA Mario Tennis with fishing.
10.
Aaron has a double load of Kirby impressions with Kirby Return to Dreamland, the now renamed Wii game, and Kirby Mass Attack, the DS game in which you control a lot of Kirbys.
On 2DS.
Josh has impressions of Madden NFL 12 on Wii. It's a Madden game, so it's exactly the same as last year. And Pedro has an editorial called Operation Rainfall, Why Nintendo Should Support the Developers.
All right, to wrap things up, we've got Andrew's blog called My Bewildering Nintendo Australia Repair Adventure. And if you remember the saga of James with his boxes of shoes trying to get his Xbox repaired, I think you will want to read this. I didn't go through it in detail, but it's really long, so you can imagine that there's probably
It's for an N64, so that perhaps will give you a sense of the intrigue.
It is a bit surrealist, let's put it that way.
And finally, NWR is now hiring a website programmer, so if you've got the skills, we can put you to work. Check out the website for more info on that.
If you got the skills to pay the bills, well, we ain't paying, but...
Yes, so you can check out all of those feature stories, original content, reviews, previews, hands-on impressions, etc., as well as the latest news. And boy, there's some news this week. And lots of great media content, screenshots, and really cool videos as well going up all the time at NintendoWorldReport.com. And join the forums, too. Remix! It's time for new business. You know, we've had a couple of weeks off here. We literally took last week off, and before that we had listener mail only. So it's been a while since, it's been since 250 that we did new business, and we've all played a number of things since then. So, Greg, what did you do in the time?
Well, you know, I put my week off to good work. You know, I don't do a lot of traveling, but I thought, you know what, I'm gonna have to go to America and say Roger. DeMorris, got to work this thing out, man.
Good.
Bang some heads together, got a bit more revenue sharing, and that was the end of the lockout. So That was my work. Unfortunately, didn't have time to stop by Congress. Sorry about that.
The man has priorities.
Exactly. Got to prioritize these things. But I also got to play a lot of games in a short period of time because, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I did get to play the E3 demos, sans Wii U, of course. They didn't actually bring those demos over.
They're locked up somewhere.
Never to be seen again. The 3DS stuff and the Wii stuff was there, and a few DS games as well that I'd like to talk about. But you know, it was their showcase event. I've been to this like 3 years in a row now. First time, it was in a hotel by a swimming pool. The second time it was at the top of a skyscraper. And this time it was in a deconsecrated church.
What?
Yes.
Absolutely true. Absolutely. It was long ago. They didn't deconsecrate just for this.
It was a very well-planned event.
Temporarily.
There was some borderline occult paraphernalia for Luigi's Mansion 2 on display. I mean,
seen the pictures.
If it hadn't been deconsecrated already, I think there would have had to be a problem there. But you know, it was a bit weird. The surroundings, like they did do some things to kind of spruce up different places. Like they had a bunch of wood chips around for the Skyward Sword demo. It's kind of weird because this is one where Link doesn't come from the forest.
It's wood chips from the sky.
Which just made the whole place smell a bit weird as well. But there you go.
Well, you know.
That was how they chose to present it. But, you know, I couldn't play everything because it was a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, this is, as you guys know, you're covering at E3. Nintendo stuff is pretty ample. And they also had a few choice third-party efforts like Metal Gear.
That's not choice.
Resident Evil Revelations.
Revelations is choice.
Yeah, I was very impressed with that.
Did they have the London Olympics there?
They probably did, but I probably just suppressed it in my mind.
I would think they wouldn't, though, because they might be escorted from the city afterwards.
You know, London's becoming a hot place to set video games now, what with the Killer Freaks thing, Ubisoft. Right. And then Ninja Gaiden 3 is coming to London as well.
It is, for the media, so.
Yeah, the Olympics is obviously doing a lot for the city's international prestige.
That game will do a lot for it in the opposite direction.
We'll see. So the first few things, I think I'll talk about some of the biggies. I did play Super Mario 3D Land, as we know it's called now. I certainly didn't know that at the time. And I kind of went through, you know, a process to try to get to grips with exactly what it is, if you know what I mean. I think the biggest challenge for me was he does move quite slowly, as yes. people have said. And as I talked about when we did Super Mario World in the Retroactive, my natural instinct anyway is to grip the run button like an idiot. Mm-hmm. That, you know, just right. don't let it go for nothing, even when it's clearly much more advisable to stop running. I don't want to. And of course, because he moves slowly, I've had that clenched down like a vice. But then when you get into some of these smaller platforms and stuff, you really should let go of it because, you know, you want to slow down, just kind of make sure you get the jump right. Cause you've got analog control with the run button. That's a bit different. You know, you haven't done that before. So once I kind of got the hang of that, I didn't find it too difficult. But what I definitely did notice, which I think is indicative of what the game will be like once we see a great deal more of it than just four levels, is that the moments where you felt like they were leaning on the fact that it does have 3D to kind of justify the fact that it's got these fixed cameras and stuff was much more when there were like those comet medals or whatever the equivalent of comet medals. Yeah, the sort of secret coins that would be in out of the way places. It seemed like there was one very early on in, I think, the 2-1, where that you go in a pipe, you come out, and you're in essentially what's an isometric view of a bunch of blocks heaped up into patterns. And, you know, if you can scale them up to the top, There's one of those secret coins.
It looks like Qbert.
Yeah, yeah. So making those jumps from a fixed camera, it feels awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much the 3D is really going to affect it in the long term, but definitely, you know, that seemed to be the situation they were putting it in the most, which is, you know, something that's a secret or it's something that's additional that you won't need to just complete the game. So I don't know whether they're betting that people are going to kind of get used to that. Maybe the 3D effect's going to help them in the long term, or they're just going to lose their trepidation about that sort of thing. And then, you know, they'll be fine maybe coming back to levels later in the game to achieve those sorts of goals. That seems to be, it's difficult to tell, obviously. It's limited what you can tell from a snapshot of the level designs like this. But that's the feeling I got. A bit like some of the issues we talked about with green stars in Super Mario Galaxy 2, where they would do more weird things with hiding them with the camera. Obviously, the green stars are very additional.
Right.
Like, you have to beat the game and get everything else before you can even try them?
Exactly.
They are quite literally additional.
Given that these are sort of analogous to, you know, the star coins in a new Super Mario Brothers game, they're not that hidden.
Right.
What we don't know is how are the secret levels in this game going to be accessed? Is it going to have, like, an overworld map, like a Super Mario World, or a simpler one, like new Super Mario Brothers? And, you know, what will these coins be used for? I mean, we don't know all that sort of thing yet, but I'm kind of encouraged by it. I think there is definitely something for me as someone, you know, played Super Mario 64 way back and enjoyed it, but kind of wished it would be more like the old Mario games. Obviously, Galaxy has kind of gone in that direction somewhat, but then this is kind of doing a similar thing, but from a different angle. And hopefully it's going to work out where they don't lean too heavily on the 3D effect, because it just doesn't seem like many people are very sanguine about that.
Greg, didn't you get the feeling, though, that this really needs some work?
Not necessarily.
I didn't.
That's how I felt. I mean, I'm always optimistic about Nintendo first-party games when I play them in a demo format. But usually I feel like this is surprisingly polished for an E3 demo. And with that game, I really felt like, wow, there are a couple of pretty major things that they probably need to twist a little bit to get this feeling right.
See, here's where you got the limitation. For me, I felt the limitations of obviously just being able to play four levels in the sense that the weirdness of having analog control but a run button and the fact that he's kind of slow to start with. And then, you know, maybe how the jumps kind of work differently accordingly. Those sorts of, is it just because it's different? And then once you get used to them and they're reliable, they make sense in the context of the level designs that exist, or is it just that they're off? I don't know. I mean, from that amount of time with the game, I couldn't tell you. It didn't feel that bad. I'd just like to say that first of all. And I did get somewhat used to them just in the time that I did play it. But in terms of projecting out over the whole game, it's very difficult to get a feel for that. But as I said, one of the things is just that, you know, if he plays like Galaxy, you know, Mario stops on a dime if you want him to. It's very un-Mario in a way, because what's the signature element of the original Super Mario Brothers is inertia, is the fact that he has momentum and you have to account for that. And yet, in the Galaxy games, Mario
But that also applies to Sunshine and Mario 64 before that.
Oh, I think it does, but I think they really tightened it to the maximum in Galaxy. And then what they had is Luigi was slippery.
Yeah.
Luigi, you had to account for that. And I think because you've got the whole run button thing here, and they're going much more towards the 2D games in a lot of aspects, because it is fixed camera, because the levels are linear, and they're short, and they have a flagpole and all that kind of stuff, you are going to have to think about inertia again with Mario in a 3D game. And again, there's a question of whether that's just something that's going to take some getting used to when you're used to playing Galaxy and its predecessors, or whether, you know, they haven't quite got the handling right.
I really don't see it as a major cause for concern at the moment. I mean, it didn't feel bad to me. I mean, it felt different.
Yeah, see, that was my main thought, different. But it's got to match the level designs for me. That's the real test.
Yeah, I mean, the demo isn't exactly exhaustive of what we're going to see.
No.
No, but even within the demo, I found that there were multiple places when I played this game like three times at E3, and I found that there were multiple places where I felt like I was dying. I was trying to do a jump that seemed fairly simple to do, and yet because of the controls primarily, and maybe it's just that I'm not used to them, but I found that I was dying in places where I was not expecting to die. Like that things that seemed simple and easy to do that should have been natural, and yet when I actually did them, Mario just didn't go as far as he should have. He ended up, I found a lot of places where he ended up sort of sliding down the side of the level rather than just make the jump. And then when I tried to jump off, he just jumped away from the wall and into the void. So I thought it was really frustrating. You know, I mean, I've played every Mario game, and this, I don't know, it didn't click with me the way I would expect it to, and that's why I kind of feel like maybe there's some tweaking that needs to be done. I mean, I'm okay with them doing something that's a little bit different than they've ever done before, of course. But when you say it has to fit with the level designs, I would say based on the demo, I don't think it does right now.
I didn't get that impression.
That's the question for me. But I mean, it's going to be different for everyone because people bring different things with them in terms of, you know, I mean, as I said, this is a weird one because it's like, what do you bring with you? Do you bring your new Super Mario Brothers brain with using the run button, or do you bring your Galaxy brain from using the analog control?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a natural situation where veteran Mario players are going to approach it a little bit differently and might well get a bit frustrated with it early on. The question is whether that subsides and into a sort of satisfying point later on, and obviously we're not sure yet, but it's telling that they've gone for this bizarre midpoint of a name, Super Mario 3D Land, you know, that in the end they couldn't really commit to it being, you know, new Super Mario Brothers 3D, or they couldn't really commit to it being something in the 64 Sunshine Galaxy lineage. Mm-hmm. That it is this weird halfway house, and the fact they've called back to Mario Land is very odd indeed.
I hope it means they're bringing on Hip Tanaka to do some of the music.
That would be great, wouldn't it? Because most of the music there seemed like it was just straight out of Galaxy, like it was placeholder stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that they hadn't necessarily done the soundtrack yet.
But, you know, one thing we haven't brought up yet in regards to this game, but I think it's a real factor, is the fact that you are playing with a circle pad. And I know I've complained about the Circle Pad before, and I'm not just trying to pile on here, but this is a game that because of the fixed camera view, a lot of times the game wants you to just go right, just straight right, but you have 3D control of Mario. And the problem is with a Circle Pad, there aren't the notches that we've had in all the other 3D Mario games. And so now you're trying to move in cardinal directions in a 3D space with a 3D controller that doesn't give you that guide that you've always had in the past in a game like this. And I found that it was hard to adjust to. I found that Mario was kind of going off at little angles that I didn't want him to, you know, because there's a lot of essentially quote unquote 2D gameplay in Mario Galaxy 2, for instance, you know, where you can move in and out, but you don't need to because the stage is basically 2D.
Oh, but there are parts of Galaxy 2 where they actually don't give you that option.
Right. It does both.
They do fix it, and it's telling that they do that because basically they think, well, actually, you know, if we don't in certain cases, he will go off at weird little angles, even with the notches that you have on a Wii control stick.
Yeah.
They're concerned about that. And then here, the problem could be worse, as you say, because the Circle Pad doesn't have those, and there's no kind of locking it down.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly from what we've seen. And yet, because it is emphasizing 3D, stereoscopic, and environmental, that I don't think there will be any of that sort of, you know, essentially 2D gameplay in it. So, yeah, I think that's a very, very real concern.
I don't know if there won't be any. I think you could certainly work the 3D effect, kind of get the terrarium perspective in there. I mean,
you could. It just, I don't know. The problem is, if it's trying to establish the fact that this is something different, you're something unique to 3DS, which is, you know, as we've been talking about, you really need that right now.
Yeah,
you need something that's like, yeah, this is, you could only do this on 3DS. This is special. Buy the system for it.
I want this game to be awesome. Because I want to play a game of this kind on my 3. I mean, it really needs this kind of a game, and I really want to be playing it. It's just, I don't know. I mean, the E3 demo left me weirdly cold.
I was definitely warmer on it than that, but I think the questions that come out of what you're experiencing are very valid. They're going to apply to a lot of people that want to play the game. And how much of that can be addressed with balancing, how much of it can be addressed with experience with the game is another thing. But I mean, I think there is a danger because it's sort of triangulating two breeds of Mario games that exist. And by this point, we know very well, especially because they've been hitting them so much harder in the past hardware cycle. You know, two Galaxy games, two new Super Mario Brothers games, not the sort of thing that we had before. You know,
right.
Mario games are very infrequent. They're about once every 6 years. People have a very definite sense of what a Mario game is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's either this thing or it's that thing. And this has the capacity to upset them because it isn't either one of them. Unless, of course, it is just so great that it wins them over, which obviously is what Nintendo's going for. But it could be difficult. I mean, I think the worst case scenario is that it kind of falls into an unhappy place, not unlike Metroid Other M did.
Where it pleases some people, but not others. And what Nintendo really can't afford, I think this would be kind of unprecedented, is to release a big new landmark Mario game and have a mixed reception to it. Because Mario, among all of the Nintendo franchises, is sort of the one that's always a home run that everybody loves. And if they release this game and half the people love it and half the people really don't get it or just don't care for it very much, I think that's very bad for the brand.
I'm not sure that there's going to be that much of a risk of that occurring, though. I mean,
That's pretty much how the E3 impressions shook out. It's about half the people loved it and half the people said, I don't know, it doesn't feel right. I'm not really all that big on it. So, I mean, if that ratio needs to improve in the final release, that's what I'm saying. Because if the mixture of people who like it and don't like it is the same in the final game, I think that's bad for the Mario brand. Whereas right now, they still have time to do something about it.
And there's a lot of pressure on it. Even now, with the price cut, there is going to be a lot of pressure on that game to sell 3DSs. Now, of course, you do have Mario Kart as well, which I got to play, which has been a juggernaut sales-wise. But, you know, Mario Kart is a bit more familiar.
And it's also fucking awesome on 3DS.
I was very pleased with it. You see, it was very much sort of the flip side of the Super Mario 3D Land situation, where as soon as I started steering with the Circle Pad, I thought, this feels fine.
Mm-hmm.
This feels spot on. I was doing the drifting and I was flying and going underwater and all, and it all felt great. Looked really nice. I thought the graphic style is simple, but because it's actually 3D at a really high frame rate, there was something more striking about it. You know, obviously we've talked about how these games, a lot of them, they run in, you know, 60 frames or whatever in 2D, and then it kicks down in 3D. But because this was just so smooth in the 3D mode, it felt like it was seeing 3D in a slightly different way almost. It was just really nice to look at and played very well. So obviously with a Mario Kart game, the two major things are the track design and the feature set. And those are open questions at this point.
Yeah.
You know, the feature set wise, if we haven't talked about, they're going to use Street Pass, Spot Pass, online leaderboards, online play.
They have to use Street Pass. If Street Pass is ever going to take off and become a cultural thing, Mario Kart has to be the game that does it.
They're going to, but they just haven't said exactly how yet.
Yeah.
And I hope they really hit it out of the park. I mean, Mario Kart Wii does a great job with a lot of the features on Wii, you know, within that constraint. It does a lot of things right.
It's still the best online game on the system.
But like the way it handles the leaderboards, so you can see like your friends on there.
There's a channel.
Yeah, the dedicated channel. You can like race ghosts of each other in sort of back and forth challenges, which definitely Street Pass wise, you know, the DOA's already done that. That's a lock, I think, that you're going to have that kind of thing being passed across by Street Pass. And then just the online play, the way it worked on Wii, where like you could see your friend online, and then if they were racing against a bunch of random people, you could just join into their random race.
Mm-hmm.
You could obviously set up a room dedicated for just you and your friends, but you could do that too. It's going to be the same sort of developers and everything, and they're going to have the same kind of priority. So I'm very hopeful on that front that it's going to be very robust, and
right.
it's going to be the sort of thing that really kickstarts the online gaming side of 3DS.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I'm just ready for the next time it gets demoed with a new demo. I mean, that makes sense.
They might also do a demo on the eShop, because that's supposed to launch before the end of the year.
Yeah, that's right. Reggie talked about that at E3.
That'll get people's attention if you throw out a Mario Kart demo.
Well, that would be a very interesting place to start.
I mean, I feel like they haven't done a really good demo of what they have in mind for the multiplayer here.
No, there's a lot of things, because also you've got to think about battle mode, you know,
right.
You haven't seen any of that yet, you know, and that kind of went a bit sideways on Wii because it went all team, which
right.
is not really, you know, what people think of with battle mode, so you, know,
yeah.
you need to show that you could, that's back and it's better than ever kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that depending on what we see out of that is probably what they're going to show next time.
Yeah, it'd be a natural thing to show, but I'm encouraged. I mean, yeah, it's Mario Kart. It's a relatively known quantity, but that looks like it's going to be very good. And I had enormous amounts of fun with the DS1 when that was, you know, in the sort of similar stage of the DS's life.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal.
Greg, why don't you jump straight to Kirby?
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to talk about that's a bit less sort of well-traveled with the demos is Kirby Mass Attack, which is, of course, the DS Kirby game.
Yes.
That we're waiting for. I think it's just coming out next week in Japan. It received very favorable review in Famitsu 4.9s.
It is very fun.
So I played demo. They had it on an XL, which is always nice to see. It looks great on an XL. Actually, the graphics are kind of surprisingly attractive to me. Very the kind of thing that you get the idea much more of in motion on an actual DS, because
definitely
the animation is very lively, and it's definitely got a bit of that sort of Yoshi's Island kind of feel to it in terms of how sort of bold and expressive. And,
yeah, it's very colourful, very, very bright.
Yeah, I mean, you expect that from a Kirby game. Obviously, it's not like radically different from other Kirby games. It felt like it had more personality to me than the average Kirby
game. It's all those Kirbys on one screen. It's 10 times the Kirby.
If it felt like it had more personality than Kirby Wii, then you would be correct.
Oh, I certainly did. I played that too. It definitely had more personality than
the
that.
The less said, the better.
I wasn't too down on the whole game, but I mean...
Oh, he must have played as Kirby then.
It's got a very plastic, bland kind of look to that game. Whereas this has got a nice, rich art style to it, and you're controlling... Or you start off like with one Kirby, and you know, you're trying to accumulate points up to the point where you can have another Kirby and another Kirby and another Kirby until you get this whole gang of them up to 10. And you're controlling them sort of indirectly. You know, obviously it's touch control, But, you know, it's not the kind of precision of something like canvas cuts where you're literally drawing lines and all that. You know, you're kind of gesturing a bit like, okay, we'll flick towards that thing or not. But it definitely feels precise enough, even though you're managing a group.
Right.
And you could do things like, if you want to sort of maneuver them around the environment, you can kind of hold on a particular point and they will sort of get bundled together into this blue force field. And then you can drag them up somewhere. And gameplay-wise, it seemed to be opening up into some nice kind of puzzle-y kind of aspects. Like, there'd be hidden treasure chests or, you know, extra objects you could get. If, like, say you'd have a flower that was varying in how tall it was. And so if you actually flicked the Kirby's up onto it at when it was at its tallest and then topple it, it would crash and into a vulnerable part of ground and open up into this area where you could get this extra object. Yeah, things like that, I think, are going to be the real meat of the gameplay in this game. You know, it's a Kirby game. I'm not expecting it to be difficult, especially not to just go from point A to point B. But, you know, having these extra things in the environment to find, again, Yoshi's Island-ish. You know, a lot of the challenge and the intrigue in Yoshi's Island was finding the flowers and the red coins and things like that rather than just go from start to finish. So that's the kind of game that I'm expecting it to be. But of course it feels fresh because it is quite unusual. You know, it's an action game, but you're playing as a group of characters. It does feel like it could have been, you know, like a weird sort of Pikmin spin-off on DS, you know, sort of like the way they did with Elebits. They did that weird sort of spin-off on DS, you know, where you try and sort of retain certain elements of it, but obviously because it's the DS, you know, you wouldn't be able to have the Pikmin experiences brought over exactly. And just the fact that you, when you are flicking all these Kirbys onto some poor enemy and they're just sort of frantically bashing his brains in until he disappears, it definitely evoked Pikmin in my mind, sort of the sort of charming brutality of it. So I'm really looking forward to this one. I think it's going to be one of the best things to come out on DS for quite a while, really, because it's been pretty sparse this year, as you might expect.
September for us, by the way, in the US. I don't know about European release date. I would presume it's close.
With Epic Yarn coming out later, I know it's on a different platform. I don't know whether they're going to put a bit more distance between.
That was a weird scenario, though, where there were two 2D platformers coming out for the Wii at the same time.
So, you know, we've talked about 3DS. There's this sort of chasm that's opened up. But there's a good number of DS games that I would certainly like to play in that area, including the Aliens one that got revived. The Way Forward Aliens Infestation is kind of making up for the fact that Sega are kicking Shinobi out because they're putting that in September.
Right.
What I didn't know is that's actually like a Metroidvania type of deal.
I've never heard of this game.
Oh, have you not? There's like a kind of a legend around this one. So
is it based on the movie Aliens?
So yes, it is, but not directly.
Inspired by.
It's kind of building on the expanded universe, kind of stuff like comics and stuff, I think, that's surrounding it. So originally, you know, Colonial Marines, the HD game, is going to be on Wii U.
Yes.
That has been kicking around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, there was video that was kind of found its way onto YouTube or the internet, whatever, that was of a DS version of the game. That it looked like Contra 4 with aliens. And so, you know, it's like, okay, what's this? This hasn't been announced. And then it kind of sounded like basically Way Forward had been making it. Maybe it got canned, delayed indefinitely or whatever. And now here we are a few years later and Sega's like, yep, we're putting that out in September.
Cool.
So, yeah, they kind of stealth announced it initially.
Yeah, the first hint that we had that it was actually coming back, if you like, was from the ratings boards.
Yeah.
That's where it's like, okay, Aliens Infestation developed by Way Forward. That must be that game that we saw, you know, so that, I think, is going to be really cool. Jeremy Parrish covered it quite a lot recently. It was at Comic-Con and stuff. So it's got this comic book art style set in the Aliens world, and it's, you know, a Metroidvania type of game made by Way Forward. It's very promising.
Well, I feel duly educated.
Yeah, that game has got the weirdest announcements because, I mean, they're almost certainly also the source of the YouTube video where it initially became known.
Yeah.
By the way, Contra 4 with Aliens, kind of redundant because the Contra series is ripped off the Alien franchise wholesale for
I know, but
so
you do
many
get
years.
That kind of, you do get that kind of snake eating its tail kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, Contra has 100% less sleeves. Thank you.
Ripley usually doesn't wear sleeves either. You know, she's a tank top kind of girl.
Well, I guess. But
because it's going to be exploration, obviously, it is not going to be like that, really.
Yeah, that's exciting.
It sounds really good. So, yeah, there's stuff to look forward to on DS. And I having played it at the event, I'm on board for Star Fox 64 3D. It's not the most exciting thing in the world, but I do dearly love that game. And the prospect of being able to play it without having to worry about playing through the whole game in one sitting, and also the score attack mode,
yeah,
which will allow you to play the levels individually, and so rack up your best score on a particular level. And also that means you could just play your favorite level at any given moment.
Oh, you want to play the train level again? Guess what?
But no online is so weird.
It's weird because you could have online leaderboards for the scores as well.
Right.
That is disappointing, especially because Star Fox Command had online multiplayer.
Yeah.
It feels like they just didn't have the online architecture ready for the 3DS when they were working on that game.
That's a bit of a step back, but at least they have actually basically redesigned the multiplayer completely. It's a new multiplayer game compared to the one that was on the N64.
Right, sure.
It will be single card. So there is a chance that I might be able to get some use out of it, even though...
Yeah, I think that's a cool feature. And I'm glad they updated it, because let me tell you right now, the N64 multiplayer mode would not hold up today.
No, I didn't even really enjoy it at the time.
Yeah.
I only enjoyed it in the one Landmaster one.
I know people enjoyed it in the vacuum of, you know, this was pre-GoldenEye, and they wanted to do something for a player on the N64 after Mario Kart, but I'm telling you, if you went back and played that today, you would not think it's very good.
Well, it was kind of tacked on, and the game mechanics aren't built to support a multiplayer kind of game, so it ends up feeling a little shallow.
I just
shallow.
Think the problem is I don't think multiplayer dogfighting is very much fun.
It can be. It certainly can be, but in that game, it's not real dogfighting either. It's mostly long-range locking on and releasing the A button.
Yeah,
which again,
that's where the mechanics being ill-suited comes in.
Not much fun.
Yeah, I mean, if you legitimately had to get into position to shoot at them, then it might be a bit different.
It was more interesting when you did the code so you could run around with your rocket launcher thing on foot, which was ridiculous, but also kind of hilarious because if you were playing four-player, that meant that you were so small on the other player's quadrants of the screen that they really couldn't see you at all.
Yeah, just had to drop a bomb and hope for the best.
Yeah. Just shooting at pixels at that point. All right, so James is up next.
Yes, I have a single game, although I've played others, but this is the only one worth talking about. And this is Half Minute Hero. I think it's Mega Neo Climax is the subtitle, because, you know, why not? For XBLA. This is a port of the PSP game from Marvelous Entertainment of the same name, minus the Super Mega Neo Climax subtitle, with an updated graphics engine and not all of the content of the PSP games, that they cut out some of the secondary missions. I really have enjoyed this game, but to discuss what it is, it's kind of a play on RPG conventions, specifically JRPG conventions, in which you go to a stage, you have to defeat a, quote, evil lord before he or she or it destroys the world by casting the Spell of Destruction, and you have 30 seconds to do that. However, you are currently not leveled high enough or equipped well enough to deal with this particular evil lord, so you have to grind heavily. And in order to have enough time to do that, you have to spend money to pray to the time goddess to set time back to 30 seconds. That's basically the premise of the game. This becomes increasingly difficult because the amount of money it costs to set back time goes up each time you do it. The tricky part is that while it may be easy to gain levels and just simply walk right in there and beat up this evil lord, many of the stages have some sort of puzzle you have to solve in order to get to them. For example, there may be a body of water blocking your path, or a cave you have to find that's hidden, or a code you have to enter by walking on grass that's shaped like a D-pad on an 8-bit themed level. The game is really bizarre. I mean, it's this joyfully weird aesthetic that the game has adopted towards how it tells its story and how it creates characters, and every person in it, with the exception of the completely dry, personalityless hero, you know, like your standard early JRPG, is completely and utterly insane. It's probably the best word to describe it. Even the so-called time goddess is greedy, narcissistic, and oftentimes makes decisions that are completely self-serving, despite the fact that your primary objective is to stop the end of the world. I find that the game itself is actually really kind of amazing because it's incredibly long and there's just a ton of stuff to do. And some of the challenges in levels are actually pretty creative. You have to stop a volcano from erupting. Well, it erupts at 10 seconds, which means you need to beat the evil lord before there's 10 seconds left, which means you need to reset the clock. But the closest town to reset the clock in is more than 10 seconds away, meaning you'd only have 7 seconds to beat him, which means you have to find a shortcut to get there quicker so you can reset the clock and beat him. But there's no indication about that except by talking to villagers who give you vague hints.
Yeah, it's like Dragon Quest on meth.
Yeah, that might be a good way of putting
it. It's just super spastic and really crazy and weird, and just it's so hyper. And I bought this game too. I mean, I played the demo and I thought, you know, at the end of the demo, I thought, okay, I mean, this is a game I had wanted for PSP for a long time. And like you, James, there were times where I thought about getting a PSP, and this was one of the maybe 3 or 4 games that was really making me consider that purchase. And so when I heard they were putting on XBLA, I thought, well, that's perfect, because at this point, it's probably too late for me to buy a PSP and really get my money's worth out of it. Mm. So this is awesome.
So the game itself, it's broken up into stages. The primary game mode is the Hero 30, which is the mode I just discussed. In the PSP mode, after that, you unlocked what was called Evil Lord 30, which is a series of missions that follows one of the characters that you defeated, one of the evil lords. They trimmed that back in the Xbox version to just one mission. And it was actually a different gameplay style on the PSP. It was like an RPG strategy game where you summoned monsters to attack. They scaled it back to just one very long level that's a little bit different gameplay-wise. There was another mode after that starring a princess and then a third one starring a knight. Again, they scaled those back and took out the different gameplay styles that those games had. So they just became one long mission.
Those could become DLC, though.
Yeah, I was wondering if they're going to DLC them or if they just felt like those modes weren't as fun as the primary game mode.
I mean, it is $10, so yeah, they might have cut back a little bit, but as you said, there's still a lot of content in it, and
they remade all the content, which is important to note here, that you can play it with the PSP graphics, but they also gave this very nice, very richly animated cartoon style that I think looks really good. So Johnny and I actually played this multiplayer last night, and it was fucked. I mean, it was...
Yeah, it is.
Like, so basically, it drops you in a stage. It's pretty much no different than any other stage in the game. There's towns, there's some caves, there's some hidden items around, and there's an evil lord you have to beat. But what happens is Johnny is running on the map, and I'm around as well. We're both grinding to get ready to face the evil lord and buy new equipment and things like that. So whoever goes into the shop to buy the sword from the first village, congratulations, you now own the only sword. Whoever buys the armor, guess what? You've bought the only armor. So the other person has to go find stuff in other places. So I did the math on one stage we played. You can have a maximum of 4 players, and there's only 3 weapons in the stage, meaning somebody doesn't have a weapon. The thing is, somebody has to continually reset the game clock. So we were both resetting the clock. But if you didn't have the weapons and the clock got reset, the weapons all went back. And everybody lost some levels and some money, but it was sort of... You almost have an imperative if you're the one who's kind of doesn't have resources to let time reset versus if you do have resources to continually make sure the time doesn't reset. So I think it took us, what, like 6 minutes to beat one level? That was...
Yeah, in a game called Half Minute Hero.
It took us 6 minutes.
It took us 6 minutes. And even then, I mean, 6 minutes is still pretty fast for a multiplayer session, but there were a lot happened in those 6 minutes
because
the game plays out at such a breakneck pace and it's so chaotic, and I was really surprised at how they had captured or they had implemented this sort of partly cooperative but partly competitive aspect to the gameplay, because the idea is it's essentially a race to see who can beat the boss first. And there's all, as James described, there's all this stuff, you know, you kind of have to level up a little bit, you have kind of have to go find some good equipment, you kind of have to find a guy to fix the bridge, etc. So there's certain things that have to be done before you can realistically have a chance to defeat the final boss. And so you're both off trying to do this stuff, maybe in somewhat different sequences. But at the same time, the countdown is constantly going. And,
yes.
And the countdown is shared by both of you. So when that countdown gets down to like 2 seconds, one or both of you is thinking, oh crap, I got to get back to town and reset now.
Or I hope he resets.
Yeah. So to some extent, there's some communication like, are you doing the time? No, I got the time. You know, so at sometimes it's advantageous for us to work together a little bit to make sure that at least somebody's covering the time reset. But at the same time, we're also competing. We're in a race here. And as James said, sometimes it might be, if I'm not doing very well and I don't have much to lose, it might be better for me to actually intentionally not reset the time so that James loses all of his equipment once it resets back to 30 seconds. It's really crazy. I mean, and buggy too. I mean, it's typical Japanese net code. There's some weird things that go on, but it was still really fun, but just, man, it was one of the strangest online multiplayer experiences I've ever had.
So we played the first stage of the multiplayer and then a later one, and in the later one, there was a couple different paths you could take to the evil lord. And I went through this northern path where you had to fight these like mini bosses that were just absolute rape machines. And Johnny just fixed the fucking bridge for 500 gold. And I get there, I'm like, I'm at the boss. He's like, but the bridge is still broken. How did you get there? And then I'm like, oh shit, there's no villages on this side of the river. And then time expires. I had to refight that same stupid boss over again because the freaking time ran out. Meanwhile, Johnny's gone and gotten the chest and been killed by the chest that had his new sword in it because he ran out of health. Because the chest
causes damage when you... Yeah.
You're trying to open it.
There was also the time where James and I got to the evil lord. James got there a little bit earlier than I did, but I came in while he... And so we're both fighting him at the same time, and our damage is cumulative. So we're essentially teaming up against the boss. But in the end, James won and became the true hero because he had apparently done more damage to the boss when it was dead than I had done. So I was named the fake hero.
Oh.
And I believe at the time I was wearing – I had a wig on too or something because that was what I found in a cave, like this big red flowing hair wig.
You pick up some pretty odd equipment.
In the main game, there is a series of equipment called the swimmer's gear, and one of them is a – like the little rings that you can get, the inflatable rings that go
swimmies.
Around.
Yeah, floaties, swimmies. Yeah.
You have to have one of those if you want to swim in the game. If you have one of those, you can go into any body of water you want and swim. If you don't, you're just standing on the side going, hope I can find a boat somewhere. What is really amazing about the game is that there's all these branching paths. Some of them, it's not exactly clear how to get them, but the game tells you where they are if you pass through them. It just doesn't tell you how to get to them. And there's actually, I spoke about the unlockable modes. The last mode you unlock is this completely, utterly insane mode called Hero 3, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's just like Hero 30, except you only get 3 fucking seconds. So you have to basically do everything at this super precise rhythm. You know, you have to level up twice, or you have to fight 2 enemies this time and get back to the village before time stops. So time stops while you're in a village. So you get in the village, you go like, okay.
Yeah. It's an RPG at the pace of WarioWare.
Yeah.
It definitely has that feeling of WarioWare or Rhythm Heaven, but you're playing an RPG.
In the case of this 3-second one, it took me about 42 tries to beat it. because you will, I mean, it's like if you get attacked by an enemy you're not expecting, you'll lose. Because it's 3 seconds. You have 3 fucking seconds. That's what you have to deal with. You have to know, can I kill 2 enemies in this amount of time, or could I have to limit myself to 1? What places are going to cause me to be attacked by enemies? So once you get past the first part, you're good there. You can consistently get past that first town and get to the next town. But then you have to learn the habits of the next town, then the third town, then the fourth town, then finally the boss. But at some point, you'll forget how to beat the first town, so you're stuck doing that again. It's and the whole time, you're freaking out because you've only got 3 seconds. You're like, oh god, oh god, oh god, oh god. And you're like, make it to the village with like 0.01 seconds left. Oh, thank god. Like, when I beat it, I probably just stood there for like 3 or 4 minutes going, oh, it's over. Oh, thank you god.
James, weren't you saying that there's one level that just... like the entire level references Zero Wing.
Oh, yes. Oh, so there's a level where when you get there, the bottom half of the level is normal. It's the normal graphic style. But the top half is like Game Boy 8-bit sepia. And as time passes, it creeps down the level. And at the end, everything, including the villages. And when you go into the villages, their graphic style changes. But while he's talking, he basically quotes the zeroing intro. And they've reworked all the phrases of the intro almost to the point where it makes sense as a story.
Isn't there a character named Katz?
Yeah, the character is named Katz, yeah. And he's an 8-bit character in a game that's not 8-bit at all.
So so Zero Wing, for anyone who's not familiar with the name, that's the game where we get all your base are belong to us, and somebody set up us the bomb, etc.
Yeah, I believe he reuses that phrase to I set you up the bomb or something along those lines, and then I think the goddess at one point asks how he was even able to cast a spell of destruction talking like that. But in that particular stage, there's a hidden boss up at the very top of the stage that a villager tells you about. If you find him, he's also 8-bit. You're in the sepia zone, so everything but you has been turned into this like 8-bit Game Boy graphics. He tells you what essentially is the Konami code. But they've changed the BABA part. And then you realize that he's talking about trees shaped like a D-pad and A and B buttons. Down in the other part of the stage, and once the sepia gets over them, you can walk on the trees to enter the code and unlock a cave to give you a new item. And the item is called, like, the nerd glasses, because that was the joke they put in there about the fact that you were able to work out the Konami code. It's so bizarre. I adore the hell out of this game, and probably poured 30 hours into it in the last couple of weeks, just doing everything I could possibly do in it. It's fantastic. It's probably the best $10 I've ever spent on an Xbox Live game. There's so much to do, and so many different fun things in the game, and the music is also kind of amazing. except for the weird music that they play when you go into the multiplayer mode with like the 70s seductive lounge stuff.
Oh yeah, that was weird.
So the music's like this guitar rock synth orchestra stuff going on, and then you get into the multiplayer lounge and it's like
it's a lounge.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, okay, so that's Half Minute Hero. It is a very James game. But I think it hits the kind of happy overlap with my taste as well, in that it's totally zany and, you know, very, very mechanically driven, you know. There's a lot of substance to it as well, and it's twisting genres that I already love. So I totally recommend it as well. Well, I'm going to wrap up new business. I've got a couple of Nintendo games, but first, very quickly, I want to thank an RFN listener named Wick78. I believe his first name is David, for gifting to me over Steam for some reason. I don't know why.
Barbie Horse Adventure. Barbie Horse Adventure.
Wick78 gifted me Anomaly Warzone Earth, which
Damn
is
it.
A game I might have mentioned on a past episode that I played the demo for. I'm not sure. But anyway, thank you very, very much. It was quite unexpected, a very nice surprise, and I have played the game. Unfortunately, I haven't had a whole lot of time, so I've only played up to the point that I played already in the demo a few months ago. So I haven't really seen the game proper yet beyond that, but I will. I'm going to keep playing it. And just as a reminder, Anomaly Warzone Earth is the PC game that is it's a tower defense game from the reverse perspective. So you're playing as the peons who are marching along this sort of predetermined path, and you're fighting the towers that are already laid out along the sides of your path. It sounds like it would be kind of a tricky thing to pull off. It actually works really well. And in the same way as a normal traditional tower defense game, it's kind of a nice casual sort of strategy game because your choices are fairly limited. There are a lot less ways for you to screw up than there are in something like StarCraft, which is a much more open game that's far more complex and has a lot more decisions for you to make. This is pretty straightforward. You have, you know, a handful of decisions that you make in any given level. There's not a whole lot of skill involved, but you do have to pay attention and you have to think about what's going on, and sometimes you have to react quickly to change your path when something happens. So it is very fun. It has a hilariously over-the-top Australian military guy who sort of narrates it and and tells you what's going on and what to do next. And he's straight out of like a bad TV show or something like that.
He sure isn't the villain from Commando, Bennett. If you're talking off the military guys, that's where I'm going.
I've never seen Commando.
Nice.
It's on my list.
I don't know whether you can handle it.
I would take it off your list, actually. I would remove it.
No, I've been looking forward to seeing it for a long time, but
no, yeah, then you're wrong. Then you're already wrong.
So I'll probably come back to Anomaly Warzone Earth at some time when I've played a lot more of it, but I just wanted to get that out there because Wick sent it to me right around the 250th episode, and I just haven't had a chance to thank him yet. So thank you very much. And really, you don't have to do that kind of a thing. I've got enough damn games to play already, so I really appreciate it. But the last thing I need is something else on my stack right now.
If someone sends anything to John, I'm giving it back personally.
The games that I did want to talk about this week, and in the past couple weeks, I have played a number of things, although I've been busy. I've been moving and traveling still, and a lot going on, but I have been trying to play more games. Things are settling down a little bit in my life now, so I've got a chance to actually play stuff I want to now. One of the things that I've put in and put some time into is Ghost Trick. And I borrowed this from TYP when he was in Colorado back for episode 250. And I saw it in his DS, or I saw it in his case. I was like, oh, Ghost Trick, I meant to play that. I never got around to it. And he said, well, here, you can borrow it. He's a nice guy like that. So I finally got to put some time into it. I've played it for a few hours now, and it's really good, actually. I mean, when Ghost Trick came out back in January, I know James talked about it a lot, and then Greg played it.
I think it was February. Yeah, we both, James reviewed it. I played it very shortly after its release.
I slobbered all over it.
Yeah, you guys both loved it, I know. And, it did get a lot of comparisons to Phoenix Wright, and I know it's made by, the sort of the same creative director. But, other than the story has a similar style to it, but in terms of the way you play the game, I think it's quite a bit different than Phoenix Wright. And I think that comparison might have put me off just a little bit, in that I've already played Phoenix Wright. I don't necessarily need to play more Phoenix Wright. I'm not that in love with that series. I am looking forward to the Layton crossover, because I think that'll be sufficiently different, but I don't necessarily need to play another Phoenix Wright game. And Ghost Trick is actually quite a bit different. It's more like a 2D Geist without the shooting. And that was my favorite part of Geist. I wasn't crazy about the first-person shooter part of it. I didn't think the action of it was that great. But I love the puzzle-solving in Geist. I love sort of piecing these things together and figuring out what order to do these things, because that feels more like an old PC adventure game, like King's Quest. I've got these things in my inventory, or at least I have these different things at hand. How do I use these to accomplish my goal? Even though there doesn't seem to be a direct logical connection. And Geist is like that. You're jumping between objects, and you have a limited distance you can jump, so then you have to use the trick function, which is straight out of Geist, really. And you activate each object in some particular way and figure out, does that help you move towards your target, or does it help you distract a character who you need to distract, or does it help you get someone's attention? Does it help you knock something off a table so that you can then go into that? And the game seems to be making very creative, clever use of that mechanic. And I guess sometimes I feel like the story parts go on a bit too long. Sometimes I feel like there's too much time where I'm not really playing the game. I'm just going through the story. And the story's fun, but it's not like amazing. It's not like super captivating or anything. It's typical of a lot of Japanese games where the characters probably discuss things a bit too much amongst themselves, like certain things are fairly obvious to the player, but they have to go over anyway just to make sure that you understand exactly what's going on.
Wait till later.
But there's a lot to explain. There is a lot to explain.
Yeah, I do get the sense that the story is heading towards a pretty bizarre contrivance for how all this stuff happens.
It's pretty spectacular.
It is amazing.
But I thought it was entertaining enough. I mean, obviously, I think it's clear, in a game of this sort where, you've got these very specific puzzle scenarios set up, a lot of them are kind of Rube Goldberg-ish.
Yes.
All that. I mean, it's difficult to string that out for a very long game.
Yeah.
And right. I think they do an admirable job of, presenting these different situations that even late in the game, they actually introduce some new gameplay elements, which was quite nice to me. But of course, they use the story to lengthen the experience. So I don't think they would be particular. I mean, you say about the Japanese style, and that's well taken, but I think, they weren't going to be inclined to be especially ruthless with the script being streamlined, because, they wanted people to feel like, they had their money's worth. It was a meaty game.
Yeah, well, the problem with that is that you can kind of feel that. Like when you're playing it, you can kind of tell that the story is probably being drawn out a bit intentionally.
Yeah, but I think it pays off satisfyingly enough. And to me, in terms of the value question, just the satisfying nature of solving the puzzles was enough.
Right.
I haven't talked about it in the show lately or anything, but, you know, I've played through Portal 2. That's not an especially long game. Mm-hmm. I probably paid some of the most I've paid for a PS3 game on that, and it was fully worth it, just because, you know, in the time that I was playing it, those puzzles are so satisfying to deduce that is worth a lot to me.
Yeah, maybe, Greg, you and I can play some co-op sometime. I still need to finish that.
You need to finish it by doing the first bit, right? Is that right?
I need to do the first zone and the very last zone, I think.
Okay.
I've done the ones in the middle with Synaptic.
I mean, I know Neil has talked about this a bit, and so recently, as he picked it up recently, he talked about maybe it's his sort of game of the year so far. I mean, for me, on Nintendo platforms, it would have to be. It's pretty much hands down.
Yeah. You mean Ghost Trick, not Portal 2.
Yeah, Ghost Trick, yeah, obviously. Because, for a start, no Radiant Historia Monster Tale in Europe. So, you know, I could import them, of course, but I haven't got around to that yet, and they haven't been here. So it's not the most competition. I mean, I suppose if I had a push, probably the Wii's best game is Tiger Woods this year, which is very good.
It's not that sexy, though. Yeah.
Well, the last two versions should have been, but this one, not so much.
Oh, dear. But yeah, Ghost Trick is really, really good. I don't know how it sold, how many people, you know, have played it yet, but you definitely, as Johnny's kind of alluded to and I've said before, you do not have to be an Ace Attorney fan to enjoy this game.
No, you don't, no. And I would say the game, you have to play this game just to see the animation. Because I know this was brought up when you guys talked about it, but until you really see it in motion, especially some of the stuff that happens later, you know, with this, the inspector character, I know this, you guys brought this up.
Cavernella, yes.
You sort of hinted that this guy was obviously put in there just to show off the technology. And
look what we did!
And I agree, because this guy, like, dances around like Michael Jackson, and he just... But even beyond that, the way that even the most mundane characters in the game, the way that they just walk is so naturalistic, and it's so striking, because this is the kind of stuff that would just be too much of a pain in the ass to get all the subtleties when you hand animate, and even when you motion capture, you lose a certain amount of fidelity. But because it's rotoscoped, I think that basically capturing more nuanced animation is no more difficult than capturing big, blocky, crude animation. So you might as well do it big and just go crazy with it. And I think that's pretty clearly what they did. So every single movement of every single character in the game is sort of captivating. And you look at it and you've never seen a game that looks like this except, what, Dragon's Lair? I mean, that doesn't even really count.
What's that one?
Out of This World?
Yeah, it's something like that.
That would be the closest thing, yeah. And this looks much better because it's the resolution is higher and, you know, I mean, it's more colorful. So Ghost Trick looks really spectacular. It just doesn't look like any other DS game. And I think for that reason alone, you should play it, because you're going to be, it's eye candy. It really is. And I keep thinking, man, I really want Capcom or somebody to do a game in this style on an HD system, because it would look so stunning, so good. But even on the DS, I mean, and I'm playing it on 3DS, but even on the DS, it's just, it looks ridiculous. I mean, it just looks so crazy. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the enjoyment of playing the game is seeing people like the special investigator move. I mean, the way he goes up the stairs, and the other characters even comment on how he has such a flamboyant way of walking up the stairs, because he basically dances like, you know, a Smooth Criminal all the way up the stairs. But you can't take your eyes off of it, because it just doesn't look like a video game. It's pretty astonishing stuff. And the game's full of it. So I would say play Ghost Trick just to look at it, if nothing else. Even if it was a bad game, I would say you should play it for that reason. And I think it's actually a very good game. So the other one I wanted to talk about is Dark Void Zero. Because I downloaded this when the eShop first launched, along with about 5 other DSiWare games, and I finally got around to it. And it was one of those things where, obviously, you know, I was interested in it. I'd heard John talk about it a long time ago when it first came out. And when I got access to DSiWare, I knew that it would be one of the games that I wanted to buy right off the bat. But in the span between the eShop launch and when I actually finally played it, I'd sort of just, you know, it had become one of those fixtures on my home menu where, you know, like I saw it there, but I didn't go to it for whatever reason. It existed as an icon and not as a game, you know? And I finally booted it up and I'm like, oh, this is awesome. This is why I bought this game, because it's basically, you know, it's like this retro faux NES Metroidvania game with a fucking jetpack, and it's balls hard and really fast paced and really, really well done with awesome controls and really good, like, retro 8-bit graphic style. Amazing music. Amazing music. There's only probably 3 songs on the entire soundtrack because it's only 3 levels, but the music is incredible. And I really hope that eventually they make like a sequel to it.
Dark Void 02?
Yeah. Dark Void 02 or Dark Void 0.5. I don't know. I don't care.
Say that like it hasn't been done despite the fact that Street Fighter Alpha / Zero says hi.
Dark 3D Void 02.
Ultimate Dark Void 0. I don't care what they call it. I want more of this. Because that's the only problem with Dark Void 0 is it's kind of short. I mean, it's like $5 game, you know, it's not expensive. And the level, it has 3 levels, and they're large. So they're very expansive and they're very well laid out. There's not that much backtracking, actually. It tends to be, you kind of move out from a central area into different branches of the level. And the only part that you would actually backtrack over is just the little part in the middle so that you can get to the other part that you haven't been to yet. And the map is very useful. It works really well. But the best thing about it is that the jetpack is done so well, because what they figured out is that if they're going to give you the power to fly without restriction, essentially without restriction, there's a couple of features in level design that can take away your jetpack or can kill you if you bump into them. But what they've done is make it so that flying with a jetpack is always available to you, and you can do it as much as you want, but you wouldn't always want to do it because there's certain drawbacks. Even though you have the freedom of movement to go essentially wherever you want to, you lose a certain amount of precision because the jetpack has momentum. So when you move, you let off the joystick or the D-pad, and it keeps going just a little bit farther, and also wavers up and down. Even as you hover, your character is kind of moving up and down, which means you have to be careful when dudes are shooting at you. You have to make sure that your little pattern, your little sine wave of hover, doesn't take you into the path of that bullet or of an enemy that's going by. So there are a lot of advantages to using the jetpack a lot, but it takes more skill to play that way than it does to stay on the ground and only use it when you absolutely have to. So what you end up doing is kind of mixing both together. You use it when it makes sense, but you also learn to realize the situations in which it's better to turn it off and actually just jump up and down because you have more accuracy that way. So it's extremely well designed. It's exactly the correct way to do a 2D game with a jetpack. I couldn't be happier with it. So I would highly recommend it, and I would also implore to Capcom, take all the development resources that you were using on Mega Man Legends 3
and put them back on Mega Man Legends 3.
And put them back on Mega Man Legends 3 and then hire other people to make Dark Void 02. Please, 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 please do it. Okay, so that's going to wrap up the show for us. And unfortunately, we don't have time this week to do more listener mail. We did a lot last week, and we did get Jet Pilots 1 email. And actually, I would say that we've probably preempted a number of additional emails that we'll be getting between the time we record this and when the show comes out. So you could say in a way that we probably actually answered a lot of listener mail this week. But so that's going to be the end of the show. We'll be back next week, hopefully with John. And before we go, I do want to remind everyone the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to hear from you about the 3DS Frost Drop and Wii U and anything else that's going on. The name Mario Kart 7, what do you think about that? Do you like it as much as I do? Can you explain why you like it better than I do, please? And the other announcement that I have is that the retroactive poll is now open. So if you haven't already seen that and voted on it, I implore you to do so. You will help decide what game we're going to play next on Retroactive, and it's a great chance for you to get involved and figure out which one of these games that you might like to play along and discuss as well. So this is a GameCube-themed selection, and there's some really exciting, mostly overlooked games for GameCube that, for instance, I wanted to play and never got around to, and people keep telling me I should play. So go over there, check it out. We've had really excellent participation so far, and the voting's been very close, actually. So I think it's going to be a pretty exciting, thrilling finish here. So after this episode comes out on Sunday, you'll have until Thursday to do that. So that would be August 4th, I think. August 4th.
Yeah.
Will be the cutoff. So be sure to go over and vote before the end of August 4th, and then we will announce the winner on next week's show, and then we'll get started on playing that and talk about it a couple weeks after that. So I'm very excited about Retroactive, glad to be bringing it back, and I think no matter what wins here, we are going to have an interesting time talking about it, that's for sure. So a couple of plugs. Well, I know that today there was a newscast recorded about the 3DS price drop and all that crazy stuff, so if you want to hear more on that, definitely go check out the NWR newscast, and I think Danny from Japan actually is on that too, so we're blending the Famicast and the newscast together. And if you didn't already hear it, the Famicast episode 3 was hosted on this very podcast feed about a week ago by the time you hear this, so definitely go back and make sure you listen to that as well. It's really good. And Greg, do you know what's up with Radio Trivia?
I do. I have recorded an episode of Radio Trivia, so I'm not sure exactly when it'll be going up relative to this, but I do try to make an appearance about once a year when I have the opportunity, and so I managed to pull it off last week in between, you know, resolving the lockout and all that. I recorded with TYP. And I don't know whether it'll be the most difficult episode of Radio Trivia, and I try to mix it when I have my one chance. I do try and sort of get games in there that I'm sort of passionate to talk about for one reason or another. But it should be a fun lineup for people to go through. So until next year.
Nice.
Awesome. Well, that's definitely something to look forward to. You can find all that on iTunes or at NintendoWorldReport.com. And that's all, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That's the Nintendogs plus cats corollary, where in Japan they changed the box art of Nintendogs plus cats because people couldn't tell the difference between it and Nintendogs.
That's exactly right. They did just that.
I have another idea. I have another theory, is that maybe the reason they don't want to call it Mario Kart 3D is that they might actually want to release two Mario Kart games on this system in the span of 5 or 6
Mario
years.
Mario Kart 3D 2, done.
Yeah, that sounds horrible. So instead they can do Mario Kart 7 and then Mario Kart 8. Or Mario Kart 7-2.
Fuck you.
They can have Square Enix develop that one, and there'll be dress spheres.
Johnny is pressing for a coup right now.
Actually Mario Kart played exclusively on World 7-2 from Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the entire game is played with Mode 7 3D on.
That too.